We've been talking about introspection. When we say introspection, is internal contemplation into the mind, introspection. And meditation is in two parts. The stabilization part and the introspection part. The stabilization part is the samadhi in Sanskrit, the Pali language. And the introspection part is vipassana. In the stabilization part or pacification part, we have counting, breath, the counting, the following, and the stabilization. We've been talking for a very long time on these three perspectives of mind stabilization or pacification. And we have started on introspection. And introspection is a very profound and subtle subject. And we need a lot of time to talk about it. Because introspection, you require a lot of the Buddhist teaching in the form of concepts. It's very important. The Buddha reminded us that it's very important that one has to have the right introspection. That is to say, the right concepts. The right concepts in terms of where we get from the Tripitaka, the Buddhist teaching, and from various sources about right concepts, right perspective, to introspect. Because usually we use the wrong concepts to introspect. One of these wrong concepts, egoistic concepts, selfish concepts, greedy concepts, jealous concepts, hatred concepts, self-protection concepts, self-centered concepts. These are the erroneous concepts. The Buddha said it's quite important that we use the right perspective, the right concepts to visualize, to introspect. So that's the reason why we have to study the Buddha's teaching. Other than all these other various concepts we got from the saints, from our forefathers, from our teachers, we need also deeper understanding of this concept that we got from the Tripitaka, the Buddha's teaching. And nowadays, it's been quite not as difficult as before to learn these concepts. Because I remember, 20 years ago, when we studied these concepts, we have to plow through all these books. If I have to investigate into a concept, I have to put a few books on my table and put tag, put marks, all that. And then we come up with a summary of those concepts. But nowadays, it's different. We got websites. Nowadays, we're flooded with information. You can Google the concepts. Learning the Buddhist concept has become easier than before. Voluminous books before, but now just a computer is easier. In spite of the fact that it's easier, if you browse into these concepts, you may not have the mind to understand them. Sometimes you're reading it a third person, someone who's been through these concepts to tell you the actual meaning so that there wouldn't be any misunderstanding about these concepts. And here we are. We are investigating, we are analyzing, we are probing into these concepts in accordance with what the Buddha has been teaching us. And how many of these concepts are there? Billions. How many words are there in the Buddhist teaching? It depends on what canon you're talking about. If you're talking about there's also the Sanskrit canon, the Pali canon, and many, many other languages that have been involved with translation of the Buddha's teaching. And one of the most resourceful, of course, is in the Chinese language. How many words in the Chinese Tripitaka, the Vinaya, the Abhidhamma, and the Sutras? How many words are there in the Chinese language? immeasurable. Billions and billions and billions. How many volumes are there? As far as I can remember, 8,600 volumes, and each volume is billions of words. How come there were so many? Because throughout all these 2,600 years, a lot of later philosophers and monks and saints, they have been interpreting, giving commentaries on the Buddhist teaching, and they left to us a whole treasury of their commentaries. So we have too many of them, many of them. So when we are confronted with a whole ocean of bibliography, literature, teaching, what are we going to do? Which one should we choose? And should we study them all? When you want to know the taste of the ocean water, do you have to drink up the whole ocean? Do you need to drink up the whole ocean to get a taste of the water? Certainly, you cannot. You're not capable of drinking up the whole ocean. You just take a cup, scoop up a cup of ocean water, taste it carefully, taste it with analysis, taste it with investigation, taste it with wisdom, then you know what the taste of the ocean water is all about. And if you think there's not enough, scoop another cup and taste it. You don't have to drink up the whole ocean. So don't worry about, oh, what should I study? And sometimes if you are scooping up too much water, you get sick too. You really have to scoop it up and taste it very carefully, cautiously, with thinking, with compassion, with serenity, with peacefulness. You must know how to taste it. Some people taste a hamburger. I'm talking about a meat burger, a Beyond Burger, for example. And if you ask, what's the taste of the burger? 100 people will give you a different taste. Some people don't even know how to taste. I don't know, I just taste it, it tastes like meat. I don't know, it tastes good, it tastes bad. Everybody's a little different in trying to understand it because everybody's wisdom is not the same. Their samadhi is not the same. Their karma is not the same. Their background is not the same. So let's, with all these various different backgrounds, let's try to understand what the Buddhist teaching is all about. And I remember last time we talked about one of the many concepts. We say the Noble Eightfold Paths, Eightfold Ways, and we have the right perspective, right orientation, right speech, right action, right lifestyle, right efforts, right introspection, and right mental equilibrium. Now these are the guidelines that the Buddha told us, the Noble Eightfold Ways, and some philosophers and saints and monks translated them as sometimes the supernormal ways, or because they really transcend temporal affair. It goes into a very high level of wisdom, to the Noble Eightfold Way. Right perspective in the Pali language. Right now, what I'm talking about, sometimes I use the Pali language and the Sanskrit language interchangeably because they are more or less the same. More or less, not exactly the same. And I don't want to put two in there. Sanskrit and Pali, it occupies a lot of space on the PowerPoint. So in this case, I just use the Pali word. Pali and Sanskrit are quite close. Samaditti, right perspective. And we said the right perspective is the right view. So you have to look at things with the right view. And what is this right view? Of course, as I say it again, right view contains many of these views that are supposed to be right. And the right orientation is your destination, your path, which paths you take. Given that you have the right view, you must know what path, so many paths. I remember there's a poem, Robert Frost, he says, a path not taken. There's so many paths open to you. Did you choose the right path? Now, once you have the right perspective and the right orientation, then you have the right wisdom. Once you have the right wisdom, it's not just talking about it. Wisdom in the sense, in the Pali language is panya. In the Sanskrit language is prajna, bora. So right perspective and right orientation, the right view and the right objective, the right way, then that concerns wisdom. You already have the right wisdom to proceed. You need the wisdom to proceed. You can just blindfold yourself and say, oh, this is meditation. You know, nowadays, many teachers, quote unquote, I don't want to quote names, of course, many meditation teachers teach from a book. They hold a book and then they start to teach. How can anyone teach with just holding a book in his hand and refer to the words and teach meditation? Or to teach from a videotape? So you gotta have the wisdom to pick and choose and know which one is right and which one is wrong. Wisdom. Given that you already have the wisdom, the initial wisdom, then you start to what? Instead of just talking about a board, you have to walk on the board. You have to walk on the path. You have to start practicing it, right? Not just empty talk. Just not talking about it. We see a lot of people just talk and they're not walking it. We have seen quite a few people talk about morality and they never observe morality. So other than just wisdom, we need to have the wisdom and we start to what? Act on it. So we have the right speech, right action, and right lifestyle. That is actually practicing it. Right speech. For example, abstinence from flattery, abstinence from cursing, abstinence from abstain yourself from lying, slandering, foul language, cursing, flower language, you know, you name them, inexhaustible. Speech. What can people do from making speech? Many, many fatal consequences start from making a forced speech. A fight could arise from just a few words of cursing. A murder could arise from just a few words of flattery. So speech, right action. What is action? Killing, lying, sexual misconduct, etc., etc. I've gone through them. I'm just giving a brief summary. And then right actions. You need to have the right behavior. Have you got the right behavior? Right lifestyle. What is lifestyle? Your profession, your career. Were you involved in a career of harming others, harming sentient beings? Like, for example, you're involved with hunting. You kill other animals for pleasure. Well, that's harming others. That's not a good lifestyle. Are you involved with promoting alcoholism, intoxication, drugs? Are you involved in the career of promoting gambling, slaughtering? That's not the right style. Just give you a few of my personal experiences. When I was in Toronto many, many years ago, I was a student in Toronto, U of T, University of Toronto, my first year. My first year, I rented with my schoolmate a basement from an Italian family. Living in the basement, I still remember how much pen we pay. I only pay $35 per month. That's how many years ago? More than 38 years ago. 40 years ago? $35 a month? And then my schoolmate paid another $35, so it's $70 a month. And we were living downstairs. It's a very cool and unfurnished basement. We only have a desk and beds, and we're studying, and we go to school, we go to university in the morning, and when we come back, we still have a little kitchen that we can cook. And we were never allowed to walk upstairs. That's in the lease. You are in the basement. You're not allowed to walk upstairs. Upstairs is a family. And that family contained a couple about 50, 60 years old, a man and a woman, very, very kind, very amicable, very, very good couple, a landlord, very good. And but we were not allowed to go upstairs because we were kids at that time, teenagers, you know. And then one day, Christmas, and then we were allowed just to go up to have a drink. And then I keep the story short. And then I saw there was a chum in the ladies, a chain, like a chain. And in that chain, there was a picture in there. The picture of a boy. You know, a chum, you know a chum is a chain, yeah, right, okay. And then I realized that the lady, I've been there for a year and a half, and I saw that lady always dressed in black. And I started to ask, well, why are you always dressing like in black color? And what is this chump? He said, this is my son. This is my son. He passed away at the age of 15. I love my son. I will forever wear this chump. I remember my son. They had a son passed away at age 15. And later I find out that the father liked hunting. Because I saw a lot of deer heads on the wall. Moose had deer heads, a bear here. And I thought to myself, when I was studying Buddhism, at that time I thought to myself, if the father has always been killing, did they not take away the lives of the beloved ones of some animals? The teddy bear of the big bear? The little deer of the male deer, the female deers? The moose? They took away the lives of other sentient beings, beloved ones. And according to causality, if you're so cruel in taking away lives of beloved ones of others, you may suffer from the same sentimental sufferings. He didn't realize that. Somehow I don't want to talk too much because I was not a preacher. Otherwise, I would have asked and told the man not to do any hunting anymore, because according to cause and effect, if you're always sowing the seeds of cruelty, you'll get cruelty back. If you're always sowing the seeds of adversities, you'll get adversities back. It bounces back to you. So, talking about right lifestyle, we have to be very careful in what we're doing. You have to be very careful not to build conditions for the future that is bleak and gloomy. All right, and then right efforts, right introspection, and right mental equilibrium. I think I stopped at right efforts. Now, after you have one and two, which is wisdom, then you actually walk, practice. You need morality. Because after you have your wisdom, you must what? You must do two things in order to not to sow bad karma. First one is sila, not to do bad things, not to do bad deeds. Second is bhatta in the Pali language, bhatta. Bhatta is doing good deeds. More than just not doing bad deeds, you have to do good deeds. Not doing it is passive. Passively, I don't want to be a bad guy. I don't want to do bad speech, bad behavior. But positively, I want to promote good things too, actively promoting good things. So not only do we have to stop doing bad things, we have to promote good things, do good deeds. Just stop yourself from doing bad deeds is not enough. You really have to promote good deeds actively. So that's morality. So other than that, what's the next? Raising your morality is not enough. In other words, you have to work spiritually and mentally to elevate yourself to a level that you are out from samsara. Now that requires time to explain, and I haven't come to that point yet. But I'm looking at the clock and I only have 10 minutes left. Maybe let me do a little bit more on the first one, the right perspective on the first one, because the first one is quite important. Your right perspective, your right view is absolutely important. What is the first one? The first one is the right perspective. You have to be aware of four things. We call it what? The Four Noble Truths. You have to really be aware of four very important truths. The first one is what? Suffering. Life is suffering. Life is insecure. Life is insecurity. In the Pali language, it's dukkha. The second noble truth, the causes of suffering. We have to know why we suffer, why we're insecure. There's samudaya. In the Pali language, samudaya. So we know there are sufferings. We have the final origin. Why are we suffering? That's what the Buddha said. The Buddha told us that this world is full of suffering, but we don't just sit there and go through the suffering. We have to find out why we suffer, the origin of suffering. Why do we have to find out the causes? Why? When we find out the causes, we know how to avoid causes. We know how to go beyond suffering. So, the third is Nirodha. If we do not show these causes of suffering, then we don't have suffering, and then we can liberate ourselves from suffering. That is the Nirodha that we're talking about. But before we can liberate ourselves from suffering, we have to know the way, the method to liberate ourselves from suffering. I'm a management major when I was studying at U of T, and I can tell you, this is like a Harvard business case techniques of studying life. What is when you are given a case study, what do? You have to read all the circumstances in the case. You have to identify the problems. If the company doesn't have any problems, you don't really have to study the problems, right? Life is the problem of insecurity. There are problems with this company. Problems. Problems of life. There are problems of this family. Problems of this. And some philosophers and psychologists say, man is in search of the wisdom to what? To solve problems. And of course, the most crucial problem is what? Is how to avoid death. That's almost the most important. What is the most important problem in life? How to increase another productivity for $1 million? How to hire more? How to do this more, do that more? That's only a very peripheral, very minor problem. The major, the most important problem of life is not that, is we all have to die. Death. How do we transcend death? Death is the problem, not how much money you make. Death. But other than that, I'm just talking about this Harvard business case. So we need to understand to analyze the problems of the company. Then we have to know what caused those problems, right? How can you solve problems without knowing the causes of those problems? You have to find out the causes of those problems. And then, if you identify the problems, if you know the reasons for these problems, then you design a method to solve this problem. And then the problem is solved, right? Now, there are sufferings in this world. We have to find out the causes of this suffering. And then we find out a method to end suffering. And then the suffering is ended. That is what the Buddha said in a nutshell, but there's a lot more in there. So what are the sufferings in life? I still have 5 minutes when I look at the clock. What are the sufferings in life? In the Lotus Sutra, Sakyamuni Buddha said, the triple world of samsara are full of turmoil, like a burning house, repleted with a multiple of sufferings. Suffering of birth, suffering of aging, suffering of sickness, suffering of death, suffering of being departed from beloved ones. When your beloved ones departed from this world, you suffer, you agonize, you're grief-stricken. That is suffering. Or suffering arising from living with unloved ones. It's just the opposite of living, of departure, of suffering arising from departure of beloved ones. You have to live with someone you hate. You have to work with some colleagues that you don't like. There are some displeasures that you don't like, but it always come to you. And suffering of not getting what one wants, suffering from interaction of the 5 skandhas. Now, there are altogether 8 kinds of suffering, just in a nutshell. Of course, all this can branch down into many subsidiaries of sufferings that we've been talking about. We're not mentioning even earthquake, sickness, epidemic diseases, wars, genocide. Oh, there's so many suffering in this world. So, can we not say, oh, this world is happy, I'm happy? You can have the attitude of being happy. You can throw a perspective of happiness in everything you do, but you cannot avoid suffering, can you? You cannot say, I want to build up this attitude of looking at everything like a rosy garden, but you still can change suffering. Can you change aging? Can you change sickness? Can you change death? It's good that you have a happy attitude, but you cannot change suffering, can you? You cannot. So where does suffering come from? Where does suffering come from? We know there's suffering, and Buddha said we know the causes of suffering. We need to know why suffering occurred. Suffering occurred because of what? Because of our craving for sensual pleasures. Lobha, lust and greed for pleasures of the senses. In the process of craving for all this, we build up a lot of bad karma. We also crave for non-existence of these pleasures, repulsion and hatred of displeasurables and unlovables. Dosa. Why did it happen to me? Why do I get unemployed? Why do I have all this, I'm encountering all these things that is not pleasurable? You always hate, repulse things that you don't like. Craving for continued existence, insistence in maintenance of a self. You always maintain a self-centered attitude on everything. That's why we suffer. It is craving that leads to reincarnations and renewed existence. The Buddha said, we have to eliminate this craving. We have to get rid of this craving. But how? We need to know methods. And the Buddha told us many, many methods. Many, many methods to eliminate craving. But how many people are really focusing on these methods and really learn about it? Or they were too busy doing something else? I have a job, I have a family, I need to buy a house, I need to buy a car, I need to upkeep my family, and how much time I will devote to thinking about non-attachment of craving, not very much time. So that's the reason why some people like to be a monk or a nun, because they can get rid of all these family bonds, society bonds, job bonds, studies bonds, and get into pure enlightenment or pursuit for enlightenment. Lust and greed for pleasures of the senses. What are our senses? Our eyes like to see beautiful things. Our ears like to listen to beautiful music, attached to beautiful music. Our nose attached to fragrance. Our tongue attached to taste. That's why we're killing animals for food. We like to taste the flesh and blood of animal, cook the pork chop, lobsters, kill the fish, because we want to satisfy our taste. Just the taste of our tongue. This craving for the satisfaction of our taste, and want to satisfy, because we want to satisfy our eyes looking for beauty, then that arouse somehow all this sexual misconduct could arise because of our attachment to beauty, for example. I don't know, so many examples in that. And our attachment to fame, wealth, reputations, and all that. There's lust and greed. And some people would say, what's the problem in getting a big house? What's the problem in being rich? I'm doing it my way. This is the riches that I have accumulated. But if you examine very carefully, how did he get the riches? Is it at the expense of many, many other sentient beings? Did he do it the right way? How those riches were obtained and accumulated? Analyze it in detail. And craving for displeasures, why do we hate? We're living in between love and hate, between tears and laughter, between love and hate. We're always living, we're living in an emotional world. Our mind it's in two parts. One is the thinking part, which is the rational part, and the other is the emotional part. The thinking part, we call it the mano in the Pali language. The emotional part, we call it the chitta, the emotional part. The emotion, what is in the thinking part? The thinking part, a burnt child threatens the fire. You learn when you first start. The thinking part, the rational part, teaches you how to learn, how to behave, all those accumulation of languages, techniques, and all that. That's the thinking part, more or less the rational part. And or the thinking of how to protect yourself, thinking part, but there's also the emotional part. The emotional part contains what? Depression, fear, anxiety, hatred, love. We always think that love is good, but the Buddha said love is not as good as you analyze it to be. Is it a one-sided love? Is it a love that is selfish? Is it a love that is conditional? Unconditional love is not called love. It's called compassion. If you love your family members more, you love all others given the same situation, that is just family love. That is not compassion. Compassion is unconditional. If it is not your son, your wife, your daughter, your grandchild, would you love them the same way as, would you love the others the same way as you love your own family members? Actually, why do we have family members? Because we have unfinished business in the previous lives. There are four reasons why family members come together. That includes your daughters, your son, your wife, four reasons why family come together. The first one, repayment of a debt. You owe him a debt. You think, don't borrow and abstain from repayment, because he will get you in your next life. So repayment of a debt, say for example, if your son is being born as your son, that could be your debtor before. You owed him maybe $600,000. And at the juncture of death, this guy owed me $600,000. He never repaid me. He cheated me. So he came back as your son, and you have to pay him $300,000. When the $300,000 is all paid, then he died. Then he's gone. It's a repayment of a debt. You have to repay. On the other hand, you could be his debtors. He is coming to repay you. So he will be your son, and then he will be a very obedient son, and he's doing good at education. He's a doctor. He makes a lot of money, and he's giving you money to spend. He's repaying you $1 million that he owed you before. It's a repayment. It's a monetary karmic energy. It's a monetary. It's all money. This is repaying you. He's not coming to get you. He's coming to provide you with all the provisions. He expressed filial piety to you. He loved mom and dad. Mom and dad, every Christmas, is sending you send Mother's Day roses and Father's Day, giving you a lot of whatever you want. He's repaying you on monetary conditions. There's also repayment in the emotional situation. You owe him the love. Your son passed away, you're grief-stricken. Your wife divorced you, you're grief-stricken because you divorced her before. He's coming to get even with you. It's all pay and repaid. So, of course, it's just the end of the line, the limit. In between, there's always, you can't have a formula on these things. Sometimes more debt, more emotional debt than monetary debt. Sometimes it's not that. It's just a friendship come together. It's all multitude of reasons why family members stay together. So when anything happens, just say it's a repayment. It's a clearing of the general ledger. It's a clearing of debt and credit. It's a clearing of liability. It's a repayment of your assets. But of course, with due respect, that comes naturally. No grievances, no hatred, no particular love. You already have done your best. Fulfill your responsibility as a dad, as a mom, as a granddad. The whole thing is karmic energy pulled together. If you shed tears for all those family members that you passed away since many, many lifetimes ago, the Buddha said, if we can quantify the amount of tears and hold the amount of tears, just like the ocean, your tears is like the ocean water, because you've been crying all the time when your family member passed away. In every life, your dad passed away, your grandma passed away, you've been crying, crying, and crying. Only the ocean can hold all the tears that you've been crying since millions of lifetimes ago.